Roger, an alcoholic. Hey, Roger. It's good to see all you guys here, man. Wow, what a room.
Cool.
I appreciate y'all being here. I got up early to be here myself. Well, really not. There's a few places I can start from. Basically, I've been sober 33 years last August. I got sober 2 weeks after my 30th birthday, mainly because I didn't want to go into my 30s the way my 20s were, and I spent most of my 30s, all of my 30s, recuperating from my 20s. And then I think life probably began at 40. So my whole life has revolved around music. I mean, and that's, I'm not going to really blow my horn on that because, I mean, but it's what I've done. It's who I am. It's what I've done all my life. And everything that I've done in my life is a result of that. But as far as the drinking goes, I didn't grow up in an alcoholic family. My mother and father were wonderful people. And my mother still is. She'll be 99 next week. She's in a nursing home. My dad passed away in 1995. He was 11 years younger than my mom. He smoked himself to death with Pall Malls. And he died way too young. But my grandfather, on my mother's side, was born in Cuba. And his name was Rogelio Alonso. And I was named after him. I heard that he drank a bunch. I heard that he really threw it back, and they called him the Storm, from what I heard. And just because, but he was a great guy, and I always asked my mom, you know, evidently sometimes alcoholism, maybe it skips a generation or something. I'm not really sure. But she never said anything about it. She said, I asked him, because I said, my aunt, now my other relatives would tell me, you know, oh yeah, he was, you know, horrible, and he would get drunk and, you know, get violent and all this other stuff. And I asked my mom, I said, what are they saying that for? She says, oh, no, he never bothered anybody, because they were real close. And she said, oh, he just, you know, he drank and he minded his own business and, you know, he just did what he wanted to do. And I went, okay, so I left it at that. But as far as myself, I didn't drink till I was 16. And I remember being, I went away to school. My background is kind of varied. My mama was born in Georgia, or from the South, and my dad was from New Jersey, and my mom moved to New Jersey and met my dad. Therefore, I was born in Jersey, and you never lose that. But then I moved back South to go to school, and I've been going to school here since 1967, and I've been here ever since. And then I got into the music here in the South, and that's how I landed here and am still here. But one time, I remember the first drinking adventure was my girlfriend and I drove down to Panama City back in 1970. And we were going to see some friends, and these people, they were partying, and somebody had made and I had never been drunk. And I don't know that I really got drunk that first time. I got a good buzz going on that time, but I didn't get drunk. But somebody made, there was a big party, somebody made a big bathtub full of what they called jungle juice back at the time. And it was grain alcohol along with apple juice or something. I don't remember what it was. I just know it tasted pretty good. And then after a few of them, I started feeling pretty good. And it was kind of a warm feeling. It was a warm, satisfying feeling, embracing feeling that I had never felt before. And I'm an only child, so a lot of times that goes hand in hand with, I think, being an alcoholic, from what I'm told. I know that folks that that have, and my wife, for instance, has three siblings in front of her, and I keep analyzing it to the fact that I think if somebody's got siblings in front of them, you can watch them screw up, you know, and then come back, as they come back in from, you know, messing up on the way, and you can look at them and go, wow, I'm not going to do that, you know. And that's kind of what I think, that's my theory on it. It could be wrong. And as far as an only child, a guy like me, I walk outside and I walk into a brick wall, and that's and all my experience is going to be firsthand from screwing up on my own without any other extra stimuli coming in. But I just remember this warm feeling. We were driving down the strip in Panama City, and we'd had a few of these drinks, and then this feeling was like, I was going, oh, man. And it wasn't an invincible feeling. It was just a real satisfying feeling. It was like, it was just different, and I liked it. As time went on, we'd have parties through, so I guess I was in about the 10th or 11th grade there, and we'd have parties, and the girl that I was going with, her parents were, they lived on the north side of Atlanta, and they were very affluent, and they were always going to these big parties, and these debutante balls, and all this stuff, and it was all high-end folks. And me, I come from a blue-collar family in New Jersey where my parents worked all their lives, and, you know, I'm hanging out in this, you know, North Atlanta environment. And these folks were all well-to-do, you know, old money and new money in Atlanta, very successful people. And each one of them, I guess, had a liquor cabinet in their house. Every time you'd go to one of these beautiful houses, they had these wonderful liquor cabinets, and they would just open it up to you and say, here, you know. And I didn't turn it down. You know. And I just remember drinking, and I guess I was drinking alcohol, but not that first time, but after that time, it seemed like, man, you know, I was drinking alcoholically then. I mean, I was getting, you know, drinking heavily and getting drunk, and just and not being really a bad alcoholic, but just it was fun at the time. You know, I was young, I could knock it out and bounce back the next day. You know, if I did that now, I'd be in the bed for a month, right? but it didn't matter, and so. It's just when our senior, you know, when we graduated I went to Woodward Academy as a boarding student. That's why I was going to school here. And so, but I'd gotten into the music really big time. I mean, from the time I was 16, I'd gone down to Piedmont Park, and I'd always been playing music since I was 9 years old, and I always just loved it. And I was in the band at school, and I was the drum major during my senior year. So I had a lot of extra great experiences. And as far as the drinking, it just seemed like the drinking went hand in hand with that. And it doesn't, it's not supposed to, but you hear about a lot of musicians. I mean, I guess a lot of folks that we've heard over the years, the problem is that some of these musicians that you would follow and idolize probably like believe their own hype. You know, a lot of times, like, you hear about guys like Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin, and, you know, the three icons that we think about that died early at age 27 from just about drinking themselves to death, because they wake up, you know, it seems like they would wake up in the morning, read the newspaper, and believe their own hype and go, okay, I can do that, you know. And that's kind of what I surmised early on and never wanted to go there. But I started teaching guitar lessons when I was 19 years old, and I opened my own business, and I'd been in Jersey for a year, and then I came back to Atlanta and did that for a living. And I was working in radio early on, and so I had a full-time music career at 19, 20, 21 years old. And I would be on the radio at 88.5 back at Georgia State, but then back in those days, the music was the whole thing. You know, the drinking age just turned 18, and everything was like, you know, why? And it turned 18 the year I got out of high school, which was like, uh-oh, you know. I mean, they just like opened the door for me, you know, to come on out. But back then, the music and the drinking age, it went hand in hand. It was all, you know, it wasn't about discos and electronic music and stuff that's going on today. It was all about live music from young folks on through, and so everybody was out, and it was a big party. And so then I was teaching, and I was running around hanging out like at the Electric Ballroom and all these places in Atlanta where all these big bands were coming through, touring bands that I had known, and I was getting to hang out with some pretty big names, and these guys were throwing them back like it was no tomorrow. I thought, okay, well, that's cool. That works. And then later on in 1978, I put my own band together. And we started going on the road. And the whole thing about it, there was a band that actually played my senior prom in 1972. And they had an album out that came out on Capricorn Records just before they played that prom. And I had already seen these guys a bunch. They were wonderful musicians. They were just incredible. A couple of them are deceased now, but I'm still in touch with some of them. But they really greatly inspired me and taught me a lot of what I know about my profession. But they had an album called Drinking Man's Friend that came out right when I graduated from high school. And they played my senior prom, and here I am in a tux and my girlfriend, and these guys are like, you know, rock and roll guys. And so I'm standing there in a tux talking to these guys. And the next day, well, the cover on the album has a picture of a beer can, like an old Pabst can with their name emblazoned in the middle of it. And the front of it is the beer can, and the back of the album is the beer can smashed up. So, but the next day I ran out, the first day out of high school, I ran out and grabbed that album and just was listening to it. And just because I loved the band. And I went back to Jersey for a year, and the drinking age had changed back there too, pretty quick. So that really opened the door. And so that was in 72, so I'm kind of jumping around here, but that really kicked in the drinking. And then back here in Atlanta, I put my own band together in 78, and we started going on the road. And it was a big, so as a result of me knowing these other guys that had this album out, and their whole thing was about having the biggest bar tabs you could probably have anywhere on the road. And the band's name was Eric Quincy Tate. And a lot of you folks that were around in the day might remember them. I know Dave does here. But anyway, but these guys were great guys. They were just great players. But the alcohol thing was kind of a badge of honor at the time, I thought. And I remember being on the road somewhere, and we were playing a club. And we were all about drinking, too. We were kind of an offspring of that band. We were all about having a party. I mean, after the gig, we were partying. And the next day, we'd come back and do it again. And once again, like I said, back in those days, I could bounce back pretty easily. And, of course, it did start getting harder later on. But I remember being in a bar one night somewhere out on the road, and we were, like, running some pretty big bar tabs. And the owner came up to one of us and said, "Oh man, you guys want to go easy? You know, you guys have got almost as big a bar tab as Eric Quincy Tate." And we went, "Cool." It's like, so, but again, that was when it was fun. Okay, it was fun, and it seemed harmless at the time. I only had one DUI, and that was in early 1977. Either 76 or 77, I think it was 77. And I remember I was playing a gig somewhere in North Atlanta, and never got into this business for the money, but so we're playing a gig for beer and tips, right? And we're having a good time, and I was way out there, but anyway, the club owner got really mad at me for drinking too much beer, you know, on a gig where you're being paid to drink, you know, by drinking beer. And so I got really mad. And this was, I remember getting in my van and driving to the south side. The girl I was going with at the time lived on the south side, so I was heading that way. But anyway, I'm out on I-75 over by Moores Mill Road, and I'm in a Volkswagen van doing about 80 miles an hour in the left lane. And, so I look into the rearview mirror, and there's a state patrol right behind me. You know, he doesn't have his lights on, but I knew what was happening. And so I got down to 10th Street, and the lights went on. He pulled me over, you know. And there was when I got out of the van, there was none of the walking a few steps and doing this and that, whatever you do. The cop just goes, just get in the back of the car. So that was the only time. Now this was right when DUIs were starting to become serious business, and I know they are serious business. I mean, that was no picnic then for me, but they were only talking about it on the air, on the radio and TV and in the media about taking your license when you for your first DUI, for taking your license for a year. And that had me a little concerned, but it hadn't been enacted yet. And somehow through my career of teaching, I had a lot of great guitar students, you know, of all ages and walks of life. And so I was a member of teaching an attorney, and I told him, you know, my plight that I had to deal with. And somehow he got me to go through this, to go in early, a month early for my court case with the judge, without having to go to court with a lawyer. And so I remember going downtown to Atlanta about 8 o'clock in the morning, and the head of the attorney firm that my friend had turned me on to, he charged me $250. And so obviously the judge and the lawyer were in cahoots with each other. And they took me, and so here I am, 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, this long-haired kid in a suit, 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, going, okay. And I go into the judge's chamber with the lawyer, and the lawyer and these guys were just having a good time with me. They were just having fun. The judge says, or the lawyer says, Judge, this guy was driving a Volkswagen van 80 miles an hour out there on I-75. And he says, man, that thing wouldn't do 50 downhill in a tailwind. Yeah. I'm sitting here going, oh, my God. And the judge says to me, looks at me, he goes, son, where did you get this lawyer? You know, they're just messing with me. And then he hits the gavel and he goes, all right, $200, keep your license, get out of here. And that's the way it went. And it never went on the record. Now, that being said, I drank another 6 or 7 years until 1983. All right, when it started getting bad, I actually wrote a book, and I wrote the whole chapter in the book, and I'm not here trying to sell books, although a couple of guys did make a run on it today. That's cool, and there are some here, but other than that, that's as far as I'm going to go with it. But anyway,
Two for one, isn't it?
What's that?
Two for one.
Yeah, right. Whatever. The reason I wrote it, I had to get the story out because it was just the last adventure was just. Was just really horrible, and really, it in the last days of, I'm not sure how many, you know, several years, that it just wasn't getting fun anymore. It was obviously, when something stops being fun, you really need to stop doing it. And being alcoholics, and for myself, I don't think we always realize that. Obviously, by reading the Big Book, I know that's true. But even Elvis said it along the line when he was making music back in the early days, you know, they were having some clashes of different issues or whatever it was. I don't even know. He just says, you know, when it's not fun anymore, and all they were doing was cutting tunes that they wanted to do. But it says, when it's not being fun anymore, then we don't need to be doing it. And that's the same way with my drinking. That's what happened. So remember the last time... The last day that it all happened was in on my birthday, on my 30th birthday of, I guess, 1983. And this was, we were on a road gig, and we were in Brunswick, Georgia. Now, Brunswick, Georgia was where my great-grandmother was from, and my grandmother was born there. My great-grandmother's house is still there. My whole family history on my mother's side comes out of that area. And so I was thinking that maybe this could be kind of a good time to go, you know, check out the family roots and, you know, the old place and all that. So we were playing this club, had about a 4-day engagement. And we got down there, and I even had some relatives come up from Jacksonville to see us, you know, and all that. And it was just a great night for the first set. After the first set, you know, those folks left to go travel back, and... evidently, we had stumbled into a club that, you know, was on its last leg. I think it had been the tail end of the urban cowboy thing. You know, before that had been a disco, then it was an urban cowboy thing, and that was fading out. The cowboy hat thing was going away. And so I even say in the book that they probably would have put chimpanzees on the stage if they could have gotten people in the place. You know, it wouldn't have mattered. But anyway, we got fired. And I was very distraught about it. So the rest of my band left to go back to Atlanta, and my roadie and truck driver and I just decided to make an adventure, and we went down to Florida. And I went to visit my relatives in Jacksonville, and we stayed there and drank for about 3 days. And I was thinking it was kind of making it better, but it wasn't. So on the way back, a few days later, I dropped my friend off, and he went back over to Alabama, and I'm heading back up and driving the truck. And the transmission goes out on the truck. And what it should have taken about a four-hour drive to get home took about 14 hours because the transmission was going out, and I was just losing gasoline. And anyway, I was becoming really, really distraught, and it was just absolutely horrible. I couldn't have gotten any worse. I spoke about that. I felt like any dream that I had was going away. You know, I mean, if I had been, I remember driving in from south of Atlanta, I remember seeing airplanes landing at the airport, and I thought, yeah, when I was a kid, you know, maybe I wanted to be a pilot, you know. I said, well, that dream's gone. You know, then I'm driving past the old Fulton County Stadium, and I always want, you know, as a kid, you want to be a baseball player. But that didn't happen to me. But, you know, it was a dream as a kid, and I'm driving by that, and I'm looking at the Fulton County Stadium, there's a ball game going on, going, well, that dream is gone. As far as any dream I might have had of being a truck driver, that was gone. I didn't even consider it because the truck was already, I'd had enough of that. But anyway, everything was in a lurch. It was really a bottom. So I got home, and then, you know, for 2 weeks or so, 2 weeks later, I went to a party, and I just got, finally just got drunk, just absolutely a blackout, a walking blackout. And I remember driving, well, I don't remember driving, I remember waking up, but I drove 40 miles in a blackout, but I woke up the next morning and I was thinking, man, I don't remember anything. You know, I was hoping, you know, that it was okay and everything was fine, but it wasn't. And so that last day, I woke up in the morning, and my first wife at the time, she told me, she said, you know, you really did it this time. And so I had pissed everybody off at the place. I mean, it was really bad. And I don't remember everything that I had done other than the fact that I was just a jerk. So I really didn't know which way to turn. And I don't know if I prayed or not. I don't think I did, but maybe God was just like looking out for me and going, maybe I might give the poor sap a break. You know, I don't know. So the phone rang, and it was a musician friend of mine from a big time band in Atlanta, and a friend of mine, and he was just calling up to say hello, to see, you know, check in, see how things are going. And I told him, I said, well, man, I'm not doing well at all. This is horrible. And he goes, and he and I had been out drunk before and poured each other in and out of bars, you know, from time to time, you know, having fun and got each other home. I remember I took him home one time and he fell inside the vestibule of his house and rolled up in a Persian rug and went to sleep, you know. So he didn't have anything on me. I didn't have anything on him. You know, it was just like, you screw up tonight, I'll screw up tomorrow. You know, that's the way it was. But after that happened, he told me on the phone, he said, oh, I didn't know you had that bigger problem, you know. And I said, well, I didn't either, you know, but I said, everything's done. And he says, well, but he, now by this time he had been in the program 4 months, and but he went to rehab. And that's one thing I didn't go to rehab. Unfortunately, I didn't kill anybody. I didn't go to, you know, I did go to jail one time, but it wasn't here. It was 7 years before. And so he said, well, he told me, you got, I said, 4 months? How'd you do that? He says, well, I can show you what I did, you know. I said, well, show me, you know. Tell me, let me know. He says, well, I'm going to this place, and this was on a Sunday, on my last drunk, last waking up, last hangover, whatever. And he says, well, I'm going to this place on Wednesday. And he says, don't drink between now and then and meet me there. And I didn't know what he was talking about. But I said, man, whatever it takes. Whatever. I mean, I knew now this was it. This is whatever it takes. I'm 2 weeks into being 30. I'm going, I got to do something. This cannot go on, because what started out being fun was not fun at all anymore. It wasn't fun. And I also knew that there had been times in before that maybe I might quit drinking. Actually quit drinking for a month and a half. I remember doing that. And I remember having more time on my hands. I remember feeling better. I remember like, that's kind of cool. But I always knew in the back of my mind that I would drink again. I knew that would happen. But this time I had to really, something had to get serious. And so I waited a few days, and I remember teaching a few lessons. And I remember on that Wednesday night, I got done teaching at my studio down in Buckhead. And this was at the meeting he was taking me to. Was out on the west side. It was at the old Atlanta West Hospital, which is long gone now. I think tore it down and made a Home Depot. And I didn't know what I was getting into, so I couldn't get there fast enough. I mean, I went out I-20, and I got to the place, and I went in, and he told me what the room was, and there was a sign in front that said, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going, okay, but I didn't know anything about it. I think the only thing I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous is that back when I was in high school in 1971, I do remember hearing the news report about Bill Wilson passing away from, you know, at Alcoholics Anonymous. But then, well, I was drinking pretty good. And, you know, as a teenager, I'm going, Alcoholics Anonymous, what? You know, so I never gave it another thought. But here I am walking into this room. And so my friend is in there, and a big long table, kind of like this, you know, the length of the room. And so I sat down, and I guess I'd been maybe, they had already started the meeting a little bit. So I sat there, and they were going around the table, and each person was talking. And I noticed a pattern developing that they were going from one to the next person, which meant that it was going to show up. I was going to have to talk somewhere along the line in there, and I'm going, what the hell am I going to say here? You know, I mean, really. But what I did hear from different people that were talking, like maybe one guy up this end, he said something like maybe a higher power. I'm going, higher power, you know. And then somebody would say, you know, the program works. I hear that little tidbit of information. And then somebody would say, like, you know, keep coming back, you know. And I'm like, and all these little fragments of sentences I'm hearing them. I don't know what they mean, but I'm hearing them. And so it gets down the line, and my friend, my buddy that brought me in there, he's sitting there at the other side of the table, and it gets to him, and he goes, yeah, my name is such and such, and I'll pass tonight. And I'm going, thanks, man, you know? I mean, God. I mean, he could have said something, you know? He didn't say anything. So anyway, gets around a few more people, and the guy next to me, and it gets to me. And I told him, I said, I just told him I'm at my wit's end. I'm out of it. I don't know what to say. I got to figure out a way not to drink again. I said, everything in my life is horrible. Everything, you know, everything sucks. I'm done, you know, as far as that goes. I mean, I don't know how else I could have put it other than that. So the guy next to me, and I always get a little choked up when I say this, but he welcomed me to the meeting. That's what he said. And I didn't think I was welcome anywhere, you know, at the time. But that's what he took his time to say, to welcome me to the meeting. And I went, oh, man. And then it went on down the line, and I was sitting there probably in a daze, just being blown away by that. So I got to the end of the meeting, and they were going through the end of the meeting stuff, you know, and they were handing out chips. But I didn't know what they were doing. They were way down the other end. I think this table was probably twice as long as this table here, going way to the back of the room. And so they were doing this thing with the chips, and I didn't know what they were saying. And then they put them away, and then I asked the guy next to me. I said, "Man, what are they doing?" He says, "Oh, they give out a chip, you know, if you want to, you know, join this way of life, and And, you know, I'm going, you're damn right I do. Yeah. And so he stood up and he yelled at the guys, pull the chips back out. We got a white chip here. And he says, go up there and get it. So I went up and got this white chip. And when I went up to get it, everybody started clapping in the room. I'm going, what? I mean, okay. So this guy welcomed me to the meeting. Now these people are clapping. I didn't know what to think about it. Other than the fact that, well, you know, there's something in here going on that I need to find out about and get more of. So anyway, I picked up that white chip, and I remember driving back to my buddy's house that night, and we sat around for a while, and he gave me a 24-hour book, and we talked about it, and I did tell him, I said, man, why didn't you say something during the meeting? You know, I said, it was your turn to talk. You know, you're the one who got me here. You could have said something, you know, and he says, no, I just, you know, he didn't explain it. He just says, nah, I just didn't have anything to say. I went, all right, but at least he got me there. So on the way home that night, driving, I think I surrendered. I gave it up. I'm like a lot of folks. I've been reading Dr. Bob's book, and I know that Dr. Bob and I feel a lot of common traits between Dr. Bob's adventure and mine. Well, the fact that he's a doctor and I'm not, but as far as the drinking goes, you know, I mean, he basically had enough of religion shoved down his throat as a kid, and you know, so when I walked out of school, you know, I walked away from, you know, religion and God, and I walked right into an 18-year-old drinking age, and that kind of just took the whole thing over. But this night was different. All of a sudden, you know, I actually turned it over while I was driving. I said to God, I don't know how to talk to you anymore. I don't know what to say to you. Whatever you got to do, you know, here it is. So, I felt that. I guess my desire to drink was gone. I was done with it. I didn't feel like I had to drink anymore, at least the rest of that day. And then I went to my second meeting, and that was over in Buckhead, near where my studio was. And I found a Wednesday afternoon meeting at 5:30, and I went in there. And this meeting was a little bit different because the other one was in a hospital. It was in an institutional kind of setting, you know, conference room, you know, all that going on. This was in an old house, you know, just a funky neighborhood, and it was the old Triangle Club. And it was just it really felt welcoming. And I went in there, and there was a gentleman in there that had been in there 40 years, had actually worked with Dr. Bob. You know, he's sober 40 years, and I'm walking into my second meeting, and I explained my deal. And he was from the old school, you know. He put it in logical terms. A lot of times it's the old school guys put it in logical terms and direct terms too. But he said, yeah, you didn't screw your life up overnight. You know, you're not going to fix it overnight. You know, just take it one day at a time. And I went, all right. You know, so that's what I started doing. And I actually told him maybe a few, you know, days or a couple weeks later, I said, and this gentleman ended up sponsoring me later on. But I said, you know, I think I needed this 10 years ago. And being from the old school, he said, nah, you didn't need it 10 years ago. He said, if you'd come in here 10 years ago, we'd have told you to go back out and drink and then come back. You know? He said, you got here when you needed to get here. And I keep saying I don't always know that I agree with that, but he was right and I wasn't. So I went with what he said. But then, you know, jump ahead after getting in the program. It seemed like the tides changed from that. I don't know. I found out something good would happen. In other words, I didn't drink for a little while, and as opposed to something bad happening, something good would happen. I can't really put my finger on actually what it was, but well, of course, at the time I felt better. My marriage got better. I remember picking up my 30-day chip. I couldn't believe that I got through 30 days without drinking. You know, now it's been a lot of years, fortunately, one day at a time, but I still feel that 30-day chip. There's been years in between there. I'm not sure if I remember, you know, I don't know if I remember 23 or 24 or 25. You know, I've got the chips for them at home, and I know that I've showed up. But that's the one I really feel. That's the one I really remember. I can still feel holding that chip in my hand. 30 days. It was amazing. A little while later, I'd been in the broadcast, you know, business for a long time. I was in radio in Atlanta a lot. Then all of a sudden, a whole lot of freelance positions were starting to open up for me. And so I was working for, I started doing a lot of sports production. And I'd worked for like, after about a year or so, year or two, I had the keys to 8 radio stations across town from each other that were all going head-to-head, and I was a freelancer for each one. These were the stations that were going head-to-head for ratings. Now they're all down the hall from each other. It's all been clear channeled, and everybody owned, and one company or two companies owns everything. But it used to be they were all separate entities going head-to-head. And that happened. And then my teaching business improved, and it just one thing led to another, and I couldn't believe that these good things were happening. And eventually, I remember the next summer, I got put in charge of running the Atlanta Braves network on the radio. They put me in charge of that. I was the guy throwing the switches for the Atlanta Braves, for the network and the ball games in the control room. So here, now, I mentioned earlier that having a childhood dream of being a baseball player was one that kind of went away, and I still wasn't being a baseball player, but here I am, you know, producing the Braves games, you know, a year into being sober. And I'm thinking, it was like everything just changed. I mean, good things were happening. I couldn't have made up a lot of what was going on. So that was in 83. In 86, I ended up landing a position. Well, I was working on the traffic network in Atlanta for a long time. I used to do traffic on the radio and sometimes some of the TV things. And you know, you would have heard my voice here or there. It didn't really matter. I was doing a lot of that. But in 1986, I applied to Cable News Network to see what would happen because some folks I knew were working there. And all of a sudden, I got hired on the radio network, and I couldn't believe that. I couldn't believe that, oh, man. So this is, but I've been going to meetings and, you know, off and on. I didn't go every day, but, I mean, I was sober, and I was working the program the best I knew how. And in 84, when my first son was born in 84, after I was a year sober, which was a great thing because one of my boys have never seen, you know, been around any of my drinking. My boys now are 32 and 29. What happened was, I remember after, you know, close to a year or so of being sober, I wasn't really playing in bars or anything like that, but my wife and I were out for dinner one night, and I told her, I said, you know, I really do want to play. I really do want to do it. And she said, and I said, and plus I could use the money. And she says, oh, you know, if you start doing that again, you know, you know what happened. You know, I said, you know, the instrument, the guitar didn't cause the problems here. The guitar lays around in the case, you know, and stays there. Do you pick it up? You know, that's not what got me drunk. The alcohol is what got me drunk. Okay. That's what screwed everything up. And so I gave it a shot, put a little band together, and started working again. And that's well and good. And I've been doing that ever since. But then I ended up at Cable News Network, producing the radio network in 86. In 88, I got promoted up to, I applied for a position. I was kind of burned out on the position I was in, and Turner Broadcasting was real good about hiring from within. And so I was applying for these positions within the company, you know, just to get out of where I was at because I wanted to, you know, step up and do something else. I didn't even know what I was applying for. I was just applying for these positions that came in that I thought maybe I could do, but, you know, I applied for so many of them that I forgot, you know, what I was applying for. And I got a phone call one day from the vice president of Turner Broadcasting, and he says, well, we saw your resume, we know what you're doing, and we want you to, you know, come up here. And I'm going, And I was leery of that. I was going, oh, I don't know, you know. But then I met with the vice president, and he hired me and put me in charge of the CNN newsroom on the weekends as far as overseeing the product, the tape shows. Now everything is, you know, everything is live and gone nuts, and it's all different now. But before then, there was actual journalism going on, and there was that, you know, it was something was happening. They were on it. You know, it didn't really happen until and CNN was the only network at the time. So until the first Gulf War came along, you know, we were the only, and I say we, I mean, at the time it was that. It was the only 24-hour news network, and that's where everything was going. That's why we have what we have now with all the networks that were offspring of that. This is, was Ted Turner's, you know, vision, and he pulled it off. So, but it was a wonderful experience. I mean, it was just, I was really, and the responsibilities that I had, in addition to having a band and working and still playing, I mean, I was playing full-time and working full-time. Everything I did was, I was loving it. But it was all a result of being sober. I couldn't have been doing that and drinking. There was no way. No way I could have done it. And so things would happen, you know, I mean, as far as the news thing went, you know, there was I had a pretty good little position there because a lot of times, a lot of the news programs back then were running, they were taped in advance. And one of my jobs there was to catch the producers as they were taping their programs. And there were a couple of programs called Newsmaker Sunday, Newsmaker Saturday. These were all taped programs talking about the news things that were going on before that. And they were taped and brought in like to us on Friday, and we put them in the can, and they would air. So a lot of times you had a little downtime. But one politician, you know, saying something, you know, uttering three words could change everything, and everything would go live or something. I remember one day I thought I was going to get out of there on Saturday afternoon about 2 o'clock. Now, that was in the days when we used to carry beepers. And we didn't have, you know, and then you get paged, and then you call them back on the phone and find out what the problem was. But they were always in touch, and if I had to be there, I could be. But one day I thought, yeah, man, might get off easy. You know, all the tape programs are in the can, and everything's ready to go. And then all of a sudden the Prime Minister of Israel got assassinated, and everything changed, and all of a sudden everything's going live, and I had to be there. So it was but the responsibilities like that were just unbelievable that I was put in charge of. And I can't attribute it to the program, but moving ahead and understanding back in 1993, now this was 10 years now I'm in the program, and I would take all my vacation days, and I would play locally a lot, and then on the vacation days I would tour around the country. And so in 1993, we went out on the road in August, had about 2.5 weeks off, and I booked a tour up through North Carolina, up through the Northeast, and back down. But I was good friends with John Holloman from CNN. And you might remember John Holloman. He was a reporter. He's dead now. He got killed in a car crash. But he was the guy that was going to fly with the space shuttle when John Glenn went back up. But he also was in on the first Gulf War. He was in the hotel broadcasting live, and that was John Holloman. And he was a good friend of mine. So during the Gulf War, you had in the Al Rashid Hotel in Baghdad, you had John Holloman, who was just, you know, Bernie Shaw was the black anchor, who was a wonderful man, but he was under the bed, you know, during the bombing. Peter Arnett was the one guy that was talking they had what they call a one wire. It was a radio phone that he was broadcasting on. That was the only broadcast. So that's Peter Arnett, and he was a seasoned journalist above all of them. And then John Holloman was in there, and he's just glad to be there. You know, he doesn't care. So John used to have a party every year out at his property out in Virginia, outside of D.C. And he hired me to bring my band up and play his party. And we kind of based our little tour around that. We went up, did some dates, and we came down, and we played his party. And this was on, and it just happened to be August 7th, 1993. And I thought, oh, man. And I didn't really think about it because I hadn't been to some meetings in a while. I'd been really busy working and all that. And I'm thinking, man, this is my sobriety date. That was the date I woke up, you know, sober 10 years ago. I'm thinking, man, I got to get back and pick up a chip, you know, and I kind of thought about that a little bit, and, you know, so we went and did that, and then Monday morning, or let's see, a couple days later, on the 10th, 7, 8, 9, 10, yeah, Tuesday, the 10th, we had a couple days off in Virginia, we were hanging out, and my phone rings early in the morning, and Holloman calls me up, and he says, hey, man, he says, you know, you want to go to the White House today? And I'm going, yeah, because, I mean, each citizen of the United States, I think, is allowed, like, one time pass to go into the White House with a credential. And the reason he called me, he said, this is going to be a big deal today. This is the time when they signed the budget. Back in 1993, they signed the budget. You know, Bill Clinton and Al Gore were on the lawn, and everybody that was anybody was there. They were having, I got on the train, and I went over to across town, and I walked into, there was like three ceremonies going on in the White House that day. There was one, they were inducting a new ambassador to Canada in one garden, and then another one, they did the big budget signing on the back lawn, which was huge, and then I went into the East Room, and I was there for when they inducted Judge Ginsburg for the Supreme Court. I was in there for all these things. And here it is. This is August 10th, 1993. But on the way into the White House, I walked into the Secret Service, and they'd already checked my background out early that morning. They already had my number, and they knew everything about me, because if they found anything weird, I would have been going in. But but I was clear and clean. And so I walked in, and so the gentleman... But the Secret Service, he prints out a credential and gives it to me. He says, well, Mr. Wilson, welcome to the White House. And I'm thinking, wow, man, that's pretty cool. So I start walking up to the White House, and I'm in the yard. And you see the White House on TV and all that. It looks cool. It looks like, a nice house. You start walking up to it in the front yard, and you go, oh, my God. And anyway, Bill Clinton had built this track that went around the place they never used, but it was a running track. And I was walking up Bill Clinton's track, and I froze right then and there. And I thought, and I looked at my, I looked at the date on my watch, and I said, man, this is August 10th. This is the day I picked up the chip, because I had the 3 days from the day I woke up to the day I went to the first meeting, so that was the 10th is the day I picked up the chip up. And I'm going, August 10th, man. I said, man, this is 10 years, man, that I picked up a white chip. And I looked up, and I'm going, and I'm walking into the White House. And then I reflected back a few minutes ago, and I said, this guy just welcomed me into the White House. I said, 10 years ago on this day, the guy welcomed me to a meeting when I wasn't welcome anywhere else. How do you do that? How does that happen? And that's the analogy that I have to run with. You just can't make it up. You can't make that kind of stuff up. And I've been given a whole lifetime, as a result of this program. I've been given a whole career. I've been given a whole lifetime. I've been given choices, whereas before I didn't have choices a lot of times. And now I have choices on what I can do and what I can't. That's the heavy part of this program. But getting back to where I really knew my ego was out of control way back in the drinking days, and Denise will laugh at this about me, because, I mean, I always, if you guys see me, I always come in, I'm always wearing sunglasses, right, a lot of times. And the reason I do that is because I had a lens exchange in each eye about 2 or 3 years ago. Everything I see is in HD. I mean, my sight has been given back to me. So the only reason I wear these Home Depot sunglasses is just because it feels like I'm in the Kroger in here, with these fluorescent lights. But I'm gonna end this with y'all laughing, because you're never gonna, I ended it with the heavy part about walking into the White House. That's cool. That's like, you can't make it up. But one night we were sitting in a van. This is way back in the 70s, and we were sitting there, and we were drinking somewhere, and we were in a Kroger parking lot. And I'm sitting there, and I'm in the back of this van, and the big Kroger sign is, and you're never gonna see Kroger again after I tell you this. But I'm sitting there, and I would turn my head this way, and I'm looking at the Kroger sign. And then I turned my head this way, and I couldn't see the K, but all I saw was Roger. I put my head back up. Kroger. Turn back this way, Roger. So I told the guys, I said, man, if I get up there right now and smash out that K, that would say Roger. Other than that, I got nothing. Thank you all.